Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll get an update on the threat imposed by synthetic marijuana.
Instead of marijuana, where we know the predictable way in which somebody, the effects of that occur, with these compounds, we're not really sure what will happen.
Then, a historical perspective on how running a hospital has changed over the years.
I think there was a period of time where perhaps we as an industry were not as conscious and conscientious of patient satisfaction. And I think the competition that we do have for patients has made us all better.
And avoiding the social isolation that comes with being a stroke patient.
Both patients and their families feel isolated. They're not able to engage in the activities that they were once used to.
And that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, a historical look back on the daunting challenges of running a hospital, plus how stroke victims can gain the support they need to avoid the social isolation of that condition. But first, synthetic marijuana is still wreaking havoc in our community with life-threatening consequences. Originally marketed as a legal high, the use of synthetic cannabinoids or synthetic marijuana can cause dangerous health effects, including psychotic episodes and seizures. We'll hear with more on all this as Dr. William Paolo, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Paolo. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So it has names like Spice, K2, No More Nice Guy, and hundreds of others, but these really are very different from marijuana. Tell us what it is and why.
So these compounds were originally designed to act on the same receptors that marijuana acts on in the brain. But it seems that these compounds, and we call them synthetic cannabinoids because we don't have a better name for them, they seem to act a lot more strong to some particular receptors and they bind much stronger to them. So instead of marijuana, where we know the predictable way in which somebody the effects of that occur, with these compounds, we're not really sure what will happen. So these were synthesized a long time ago to try to mimic marijuana. And what happens with these is that they take the compound and they spray it onto some organic material and then put it in a package and market it under any of those names you mentioned. And then people take it and ingest it or they smoke it. And then the effects are very variable depending upon what the compound was.
And it's never been tested for safety in any way. And there's been really no regulation of any kind.
No, this is a constantly moving goalpost because each of these compounds that gets to market or at least gets into the population is altering from the original compounds that we were originally dealing with. So each time we get a new wave of this, we're seeing new psychosocial effects of these drugs.
Wow. And the fact is it's not legal anywhere in the United States currently. But the problem, as you have told me before, is that these people are kind of one step ahead of the law because they can make a minor change.
Yeah, so the concept behind the 2012 federal law was that any of these synthetic substances are banned. But what can happen sometimes is you can change the chemical compound such that it looks different. Slightly different, right. And so what the federal law has tried to do is say, if the compounds have the same parent form, so if it looks a lot like the original form or it might have the same effect, then they're under the same family. But again, like I said earlier, it's a moving goalpost. What you can do is you can keep changing the compound and marketing under something else.
And it's hard to change laws that quickly.
Right, and it's easy to change chemicals that quickly.
Right. So why has it gotten worse now?
It's not really clear why it's gotten worse now. What we saw an initial wave in the about 2009, 2010 of synthetic cannabinoids and bath salts. And that's probably because at that point they weren't illegal. It's not that they were legal, it's that they were not illegal. And people were buying them in head shops and smoke shops and what have you. And then they kind of waned after they became illegal to sell. And then what seems to happen is that we've got a second resurgence. And why it seems to be now is it seems to be there's two particularly potent compounds that we're seeing, one of which causes severe agitation and one of which causes severe depression, you know, kind of sleepiness and just somnolence. So I don't know why these got reintroduced, particularly into central New York, but what seems to happen is right now, at least the severity of the effects of the drug means that we're seeing a lot more of it in the emergency department.
Yeah, so what do you see when people come in? What are the kind, you're just alluding a little bit to the symptoms. What do they look like?
Sure. So there's two real types that we see that come in. One is the exceedingly agitated person. This is a person you would almost call psychotic. They are ramped up, so their heart rate is going fast, their blood pressure is up. It's almost equivalent to what we see with other compounds like cocaine or methamphetamine, in that it's what's called a stimulant. Everything is going very fast.
Do they have hallucinations, some, that type of thing, or psychotic type episodes?
Some have hallucinations. A lot are very aggressive, kind of what you would see once upon a time when people would use PCP or angel dust, that same kind of anger, agitation, and what we get are phone calls from our EMS providers letting us know that there is an agitated patient coming who has abused one of these drugs. And those are the people that have a lot of deleterious effects from it. So we've seen heart attacks in those patients. We've seen seizures in those patients. A lot of these patients, because they need so many medications to calm them down, need a breathing tube to help them breathe afterwards, We've given them so much to calm down that agitation. Because when you're that agitated and ramped up, you start breaking down your muscle and you start leaking all of these electrolytes and chemical into your blood, and you can get some of the bad effects of that. And so that's the one type of patient we see. The other is the patient that smokes it and then their friends go to try to wake them up and they don't wake up. They're sleepy, they're somnolent, you can agitate them, you can cause pain to them, and they don't move much. And so those are kind of the two categories, and it's probably whatever the two compounds are that we're seeing in our population right now that's causing either the agitation or the depression. And people can't predict before they take it exactly which effect they're going to get.
Have you seen any deaths from it?
I've not personally, no. The deaths have been reported. I can't speak to whether or not we've seen any here. We've certainly seen people ill enough to need to go to the ICU, and we've seen people ill enough that I need to intubate them and put them on respirators. Personally, I've intubated about 7 or 8 individuals on spike, but I don't know if we've seen any deaths. We were case reports of deaths in the community, and we've seen heart attack, we've seen seizure from it, but I personally have not seen death from it.
So this is really a very serious problem, and I know the Upstate Poison Control Center has actually issued, and New York State has issued warnings about this, but what happens when somebody comes into the ED in the little bit of time we have left? What do you do with them, and what's their course generally?
Sure. So again, using the model of those two patients we talked about, the agitated patient will typically encounter one of our first responders. So EMS, paramedics, fire department, and their first job is to calm everything down with the medications they can, with talking if possible, and then with restraint if need be, if the person is a danger to themselves or others. Those people come in and they get immediately assessed, and then they get medication to help them calm down. This is not just for their safety and the safety of the staff, but it's also because that agitated state actually causes some bad effects like we talked about. Typically, those people, the most common course of those is that we'll watch them in the emergency department for 6 to 8 hours, and then they'll either metabolize through the drug or they won't, and they'll continue to need escalating doses of medication to be admitted. The somnolent people are a little bit easier because they're less of a danger to themselves. They generally are not like opiate or morphine.
They kind of sleep it off eventually?
They kind of sleep it off, and typically it's about a 6-hour observation period. And if they haven't gotten better in that 6 hours, then we know they're not going to get better.
Wow. So bottom line is, what should you do if you knew somebody was using these drugs?
Sure. Obviously, there are safer alternatives to these drugs,
right.
And there are safer means of if you need to get recreational high, which we don't advocate, but there are much safer, more established means than using these drugs. If you know somebody is using it, I would strongly advise them against using it. These are not in any way regulated. There's no way to know what you're getting, whether you're going to wind up in column A or column B. So if your friend or your loved one becomes agitated and there's nothing you can do about it, the safest thing is to call 911 and get some help because they're not going to get better. And as I said, 6 hours of that kind of agitation can lead to some bad effects for that individual and the individuals around them.
So it's really overall, stay away.
Stay away.
My guest has been Dr. William Paolo, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Really good advice. Thanks so much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Now for some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Medical sonographer Lisa Allen explains the role of the sonogram during pregnancy.
If you were going to go and have an ultrasound, it's Always a very exciting thing because you want to. Most people want to find out the gender of their babies, and that's certainly not our priority. But we it's part of the exam. A lot of times they tell you you have to fill your bladder, and most women they have to drink all the water and come in uncomfortable. And yes, you'll have to fill your bladder. It helps us to see, you know, to get through and get the images, but. You know, you come in and you lay down on the bed and you get all excited and you bring your family members and we have you silence your cell phones and people want to have their cell phones on during their exam, but it can interfere with the medical equipment so people get disappointed when they have to turn their cell phones off. And we generally, you know, put some gel on and we do warm our gel. People always say, oh, you're going to put cold gel on, and that's not the case. We warm ours. And then we just take a probe and we kind of rub it around on the belly. And hopefully, you know, we don't want to press too hard. We don't want to hurt anybody. But and we get the images, and we have a monitor up on the wall so the patient that's laying there can see the monitor and watch the whole exam. They don't have to crane their neck, because a lot of people tell me, oh, I had to crane my neck at the last place, and I couldn't see, and it hurt my neck. So we have a monitor, and, you know, the patients get to watch the exam. And we generally start out because there's you have to look at the uterus and the ovaries and the maternal part of things, and then we do the baby. And looking at the baby, and we point everything out, and we have a whole list of things that we have to look at, body parts. It's my checklist, and there's probably 25 or 30 items on the baby that we have to document and measure. And so we go through, and we, of course, get the patient the pictures, and we don't always get the best ones, or they think it looks scary or creepy, or sometimes they get really cute ones. It all depends on the, you know, the baby's position, and we always joke around and say, you know, we're after a moving target, and the baby's moving in there, and we have two patients. We have the mom and the baby, or multiple babies in certain situations, and we finish the exam and give them their pictures, and then they'll move on and talk with the doctor, and they'll give them the results. So we generally can't tell the patient specific information or answer their questions as such, but can certainly point out what we're doing and make it a pleasant experience for them.
Next up, lessons learned from the challenges of running a hospital over the last several decades. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, there's no doubt that running a hospital is difficult and demanding, and it's only getting tougher. As competition and expenses increase, hospital administrators face great challenges in order to effectively lead during this time of transformational change in our healthcare system while remaining fiscally responsible. And always helpful is reflecting back on lessons learned from one's predecessors. Joining us to do just that are three individuals who, in their respective tenures as executive directors of Upstate University Hospital, have much to teach us. James Abbott served as hospital administrator from 1964 to 1971. Thomas Campbell served as CEO from 1973 to 1985. And James Rosenberg served in that post from 1986 to 1993. And they're joining me right now. Welcome to you all. Thanks so much for coming in, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to have you. So you all witnessed currently a great transformation in our healthcare system and dramatic advances in what medical science can now offer patients. I'd like you each to set the stage for what particular challenges each of you faced during your tenure. We'll start with you, Mr. Abbott. Tell us a little bit about what it was like at the very beginning of Upstate Medical University Hospital.
One of the elements was the fact that this hospital and its sister hospital in Brooklyn were the first two acute care general hospitals the state of New York had ever operated. And that, it seemed to me, meant that we had to remember that, and particularly when we were talking with our partners in Albany and the central administration of the state university, that we had to be careful that we thoroughly explained what some of the functions were so so that they could better understand the ways in which we had to operate to meet those functions.
And I understand at the time that you took over the reins, the medical school had been part of Syracuse University, and they handed it over to New York State at that point, and this hospital, the $22 million hospital, was first built, the first university hospital.
That was a sequence. The timing was a little different. And my recollection is that the state took over the College of Medicine on or around 1950. And at that time, there were expectations on the part of a number of people that one of the early things that would be done would be the construction of this hospital. There were delays in that. And it wasn't until 1964 that the hospital was completed.
What made it unique, though, you were saying, to be an acute care facility in this region, was it that there was it was meeting a great need that heretofore hadn't been met?
Well, I think the I believe it would be a fair statement to say that the earlier University Hospital of the Good Shepherd had some functional and aesthetic limitations. And as time unfolded, there was, I think, growing evidence that the opportunity to put a best foot forward, both with respect to patient care and to teaching and to medical research, could be compromised in the near future. And that was a concern.
So they were really trying to meet all those needs, patient care, research, and education,
That's right.
At the very inception.
That's right.
Mr. Campbell, when you took over the reins, I understand you worked with Mr. Abbott at one point early on. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what you faced and what were the kind of the high points or the significant issues of your time.
Well, first of all, everything that Mr. Abbott said, I would have said it as well, because it was still going on when I came. The relationship between the medical center in Syracuse and the state government in Albany was always, there was always a little friction there, friendly friction, if you might say that, because they wanted to more understand what was going on in this place up here, because it was so different from everything else they handled. And that was continuing. We used to call it arm wrestling.
But I understand you also oversaw a number of things that took place
well,
during this time.
Well, that's true. That during that period, there were a lot of breakthroughs in different types of medicine. And some of those breakthroughs ended up adding facilities to our hospital.
Give me an example.
Well, probably the biggest one that I recall was we had a pediatric chairman by the name of Dr. Frank Oskey. He was a power of person, and he knew everything there was to know about pediatrics, and he was just a wonderful person. And at that point, we had the opportunity to build an intensive care unit for children,
and
which had not existed before. It was non-existent here.
And there were plans for a perinatal center as well.
Yes, right. Yeah. And a lot of that came as a result of some of the breakthroughs that were going on in pediatrics, that Frank was right there at the leading edge of a lot of that.
So in other words, in some ways, medical science drove changes within the physical plant and the services offered.
Definitely, definitely.
And you were able to respond to those.
Yeah.
And actual.
Well, that's a part of the arm wrestling that the state could understand. They could see these programs starting and said, you know, we really ought to be into that. So it was a little easier to sell some of those than it was other things.
How about you, Mr. Rosenberg? You had a little different time in history in terms of medical advances and challenges. What was it like for you?
Well, the evolution continues in terms of the advances in technology. The situation that I inherited and was an active participant in was satisfying almost an insatiable demand for capital. And we were blessed with the opportunity at the time with a new paradigm in the state system where they said if you can generate sufficient revenue or surplus revenue, we'll allow you to keep it to invest in capital on your campus. And so that was a major shift in philosophy, and it took some getting used to on the campus, but everybody seemed to get the picture pretty quickly, and so we enjoyed a pretty robust capital infusion by those days, by the standards of that day.
And you instituted several new available services as a result.
We did a fair amount of refurbishing. A lot of imaging technology was brought on board. We were engaged in an arms race with some of the technical arms race with a number of the hospitals in the area. And to stay current, you needed to continue to invest in your program and infrastructure. We were blessed, though, contemporaneously, we were blessed with a great faculty and an academic medical center, which really was the bedrock, and it continues to be the bedrock of this institution.
I also noted, in looking over your own history here, that you really started the comprehensive breast care program, which continues today. So,
I was part of that. I was perhaps able to coordinate and orchestrate, but certainly the beginning of that and its inception certainly goes to the faculty had the wisdom to initiate that.
Now, you were here from 86 to 93.
That would be correct.
So, looking now at what you know about hospitals, what were some of the most significant changes in terms of things like length of stay today from then, or anything else that you think has
sure.
changed dramatically?
When people told me you could have hip surgery and go home the same day, which is what we are doing today, that was a far cry from the hip surgery of 1986. That was a major procedure. It was overnight, many nights potentially. We're doing that type of surgery on an outpatient basis in this day and age. And so the technology that has permitted healthcare to deliver outpatient program with great sophistication, minor, much more less invasive surgical interventions and greater accomplishments or comparable accomplishments, to me is just stunning. When you think about it, there was a period of time where you were hospitalized for multiple days for cataract surgery.
And for pregnancy, giving birth.
Seven days.
It was routine.
For delivery. But cataract surgery, you were in the hospital for 4, 5, 6 days, sandbags on your neck, and it was kind of crazy.
Goodness. Frightening.
now you walk in and come out with a set of eye drops. And again, that's just technology continues to advance. And I'm very optimistic that it'll continue to advance. And we're blessed to have that both in upstate New York and upstate, as well as across the country.
Across the country. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with the past CEOs of Upstate University Hospital, Jim Abbott, Tom Campbell, and Jim Rosenberg. And we're talking about lessons learned during their respective tenures, perhaps that can be applied today. So getting to that whole notion, back to you, Mr. Abbott. Today, there seems to be a great pressure on certain challenges, like staffing challenges. Did you also experience issues in terms of getting adequate nursing staffing and adequate, people, professors and physicians to work in your hospital?
Yes. Certainly nursing. My recollection is that to a lesser extent, but nonetheless a present one, were pharmacists. And some of the other allied health professionals, from time to time, there would be seemingly at least a greater or lesser difficulty in recruiting staff. That was, I think, first and foremost in my mind most of the time when I was working here.
How about things like, Mr. Campbell, did you have issues with regard to, there's so much competition today, even among hospitals, mm-hmm. for not only for staff, but things mm-hmm. like patient satisfaction, for patients, basically, for patients to choose one hospital over the other. Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of pressure? I know today we have things like the Press-Ganey scale, where patients literally rate their stay in a hospital. Mm-hmm. What was it like then, and is there something we could learn from what you learned back then? In terms of patient satisfaction?
The changes in patient satisfaction, it's always been a problem. And now that patients stay for a lesser time, it's even more difficult. So Press-Ganey is all over the place trying to get good information, but it's very difficult because, these patients come in and they mentioned eye surgery, It takes place now on an outpatient basis. So how can you get a good feel for satisfaction when these people are coming and going so quickly? It's very difficult.
And it also strikes me that they have less, in that sense, less, as you said, interaction with the staffing and with the whole environment.
Right.
And so maybe there isn't this time to develop a sense of allegiance or appreciation.
Right.
What do you think, Mr. Rosenberg?
I am delighted that it's come to the forefront, patient satisfaction. I think there was a period of time where perhaps we as an industry were not as conscious and conscientious of that. And I think the competition that we do have for patients has made us all better and has improved our presentation. Our education, and I think, it's healthy. I don't think you can be a slave to the patient satisfaction surveys because I don't think they're infallible, but I do think it has made us a better industry by paying attention, certainly a more hospitable industry.
Now, you were speaking a few minutes ago, Mr. Rosenberg, about technology and about how the medical, the really dramatic advances and changes in technology have an impact currently today. Now, we today have electronic medical records, electronic communication systems with our patients, things that I'm sure you never dreamt of back then. How do you think this has had an impact, or is there something to be learned? Is it potentially that we've gotten away in some ways from some of the touch and feel of medicine as a result of some of these technological changes?
That would be hard for me to assess. I would think it has permitted, if you think about technology, and it will continue to evolve, and I don't want to we haven't accomplished anything yet. There's a lot more to come.
Yes.
But when you look at imaging, for example, and the fact that you can move images electronically around the country and around the world, have different interpretations, and do it in nanoseconds, is pretty phenomenal from the days of a film library and having to call down for films in the middle of the night and try and get them up to the bedside where a patient was. That being said, I don't, what I would say is the technology, hopefully, and again, I'm not the care provider, but hopefully it gives the people that are at the bedside a little more ammunition to work with, a little more
access, quicker
knowledge, access, and they can spend more time on the integration of the technology with the intervention and therapies of the patient that the patient requires. So you would hope to think that while it will it compresses the stay, it gives you a little more time with your patient.
Just in a little bit of time we have left, I'm going to ask each of you, starting with you, Mr. Abbott, what advice would you give to today's current hospital administrators? I mean, I'm sure even in your own life you've been a patient and you've experienced, the healthcare system. What advice would you give?
Well, it's nothing terribly profound, but I believe that there continues to be, at the fundamental level, a greater similarity than a difference in patient care. I can't speak to medical education and to research, but the care. The patient is still the same person. His or her concerns are the same. His psychological framework is, I believe, no different than it was in 1986 or probably in 1906. And so I think if you bear that in mind, what that patient is thinking about when he or she is admitted, and do your level best, not just technologically, but in other ways, to make that individual feel more comfortable while he or she is there, to have less misgiving, and to leave with a sense that they have a future. I think that it was important then, it's important now, and I'm reasonably confident it's going to be important 15 years from now.
Very well said. How about you, Mr. Campbell? What advice would you offer the people who are running the hospital?
It's pretty hard to add to what Jim Abbott has already said.
I would agree.
there is an area, and it has to do with the technologist. There's a lot of people who are seeing patients once, and they have to make a decision, and they have to communicate with that patient to bring the patient along with them. And that's very difficult to do on the time screen that we have available to us. And so I think in the educational side of this thing, there needs to be a lot more done about this. You can't talk about the leg that's in room 4 or the arm that's in room 6. You're talking about Mrs. Smith or Mr. Jones and that type of thing.
So the kind of the humanity of it all, just as Mr. Abbott said, needs to be preserved.
Right.
Even in a very highly technical and technological environment.
Well said.
Mm-hmm. How about you?
Adding to my colleague's observations is very difficult. I would say that the only thing I might add would be to take the time to appreciate your staff and to celebrate their successes and be the coach you need to be, the colleague, the friend, and the leader. But always understand that they're all there trying to do the very best they can do. And they sometimes need that pat on the back as well. Their days are not always the simplest and easiest.
Very well said as well. And I think it's a complex system today, far more pressure on every piece of the system, patients and healthcare providers as well. Okay. Very well said. Thank you so much. My guests have been past CEOs of Upstate University Hospital, James Abbott, Thomas Campbell, and James Rosenberg. Thanks so much once again for sharing these wonderful thoughts and perspectives with us all. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, how stroke victims can gain support from social isolation. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of June 14th. You can cut down on meat. Eating large amounts of red meat and processed meat like bacon, deli meats, and hot dogs has been linked to an increase in colon, rectal, and prostate cancer. Excessive meat consumption can also lead to other preventable diseases such as obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. This week, why not start off with a meatless Monday? See if you can swap red and processed meats for leaner sources of protein like beans, lentils, or tofu. You might find that you're just as satisfied and you are guaranteed to feel healthier. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. Mm-hmm. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. Social support is important in stroke recovery, and social isolation has also been called a risk factor for poor outcome after stroke. And while family and friends provide important social support for many survivors, some stroke victims need more. Well, here to explain all of this is Carrie Garcia. She's a speech-language pathologist with the Physical Rehabilitation and Medicine Department at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Carrie. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So having a stroke can be a devastating experience, and for some, there's a long rehabilitation process. Help us understand that.
Yes, well, the rehabilitation process actually begins in the acute care phase. Our PTs, OTs, and speech-language pathologists are seeing the patients usually within 24 to 48 hours upon admission. Oftentimes, our patients are transitioned to the inpatient rehab unit, or 2 North, as we call it, in the hospital. And some patients from there, they might go home, or they go on to another facility, such as a local subacute facility, and other patients go straight home with home care and then visit us with outpatient within the department.
Well, what are the kinds, give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we see after a stroke quite often in terms of both the physical limitations and then, of course, the communication limitations.
It depends very much on the type of stroke as well as the severity of stroke.
The location of the stroke within
correct.
The brain.
Yes, whether it's left brain, right brain, front brain, the hind brain. A lot of our patients will have both physical, cognitive, and or language deficits after their stroke.
So when you have a physical deficit, what are you seeing? Are you seeing weakness? Are you seeing inability to walk? What are the kinds of things?
Again, it's very patient-specific. Some patients, it is an inability to walk. They might be lift-dependent, or they might be dependent for transfers and all mobility initially. The goal is to improve upon that with our physical therapist so that they are less dependent for mobility with transfers, and even if they're wheelchair level versus walker level, or they may or may not require a device at all.
So I know there's a lot of individual difference based on a lot of factors, but the fact is overall you can see some pretty severe involvement of the ability to do your activities of daily living, just the basics of life.
Correct. Those ADLs and dressing, bathing, our occupational therapists work very closely with improving upon those skills so that there's more independence for each of those patients upon discharge from the hospital.
So how about communication? Because that's your specialty. Mm-hmm. And I know from my own past life as a speech and language pathologist, I know that language disability as a result of stroke is a major, major problem. What do you see? Do you still see a lot of people having aphasia?
I do. I do see a lot of patients having aphasia and those receptive language difficulties, including auditory comprehension, as well as reading comprehension difficulties, as well as the expressive language difficulties, the verbal expression, as well as the written expression.
So some people, when they talk about the difference between receptive aphasia and expressive aphasia, just for our audience's sake, some people really can't even understand the spoken word. Those people are seriously impaired. But then there are people who have the ability to understand, but they can't express.
Correct.
And that is also dependent on?
The level of stroke, the severity of stroke, the area of the brain, the location of the brain, yes.
Now, has there been a change in terms of the prognosis for these patients based on the fact that we're doing things much faster these days in terms of intervening with a stroke?
Absolutely, and I think the community awareness has increased such that patients and family members, they're getting to the hospital sooner. They're calling 911 at the first signs, any indication in terms of the fast, face, arm, speech, time.
So that what you're seeing is a greater response on the part of the public, greater education, but also have the techniques and the interventions helped to improve outcomes.
Absolutely. The timeliness of the care that's provided to the patients within the ER, the physicians and their management of the patients, as well as the surgeons and how they are working medically to advance the care of these patients.
But you yourself mentioned that basically rehabilitation specialists are also seeing patients within a very short amount of time prior post-stroke. Mm-hmm. Do you see a change as a result of that kind of early intervention?
I do. I do because some of our patients, I think they're getting care and they're getting treatment earlier. They might have a better prognosis, as with medicine, rehabilitation earlier is better, and more is better. The more repetitions, the more frequencies, the more likelihood we can overcome some of the physical or cognitive detriments.
How often would you see a patient, for example, and when would they remain in the hospital and get these kinds of intensive help for how long, generally?
It depends on the patient. If they're in acute care, they may get therapy 2 to 3 days a week. If they're on the inpatient rehab unit, they will get therapy 5 days a week. It's an intensive therapy program in terms of patients getting 3 hours of therapy a day, 5 days a week for at least 15 hours, and they may stay there for 2 weeks up to 6 weeks, depending on their needs.
And how they're progressing, I would imagine. And then the idea is to transition them into a community setting of mm-hmm. some kind.
Correct.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with speech-language pathologist Carrie Garcia. We're talking about rehabilitation after a stroke and also the importance of social stimulation. So clearly, if a person has come out of a stroke with some cognitive and or communication disability, I would think social isolation must feel like a major concern in those cases. Do you see that more so with a person with a language disability than perhaps with just the physical disability?
I think so. If it's just a physical disability, I might not know. I may not be able to comment to that directly because our physical therapist may be better suited or occupational to comment towards the physical isolation or social isolation due to physical detriments. But in terms of the language, I do feel that both patients and their families feel isolated. They're not able to engage in the activities that they were once used to, whether it's due to cognition or language, because they might not be able to understand what's going on around them, or they might not be able to process the information within a loud environment with various distractions.
So it really does make, it's really a dramatic change in one's life at that point.
Absolutely.
And even with the best of rehabilitation services, it's a long haul, I would think.
Yes, in general, when we educate the families and patients, we talk about the brain healing for 6 months to a year. That doesn't mean that after the year the healing process is over. We have patients that return for therapy, you know, years after their initial stroke or insult to the brain.
So what are the kinds of things that you've seen in terms of that, the effects of social isolation? In other words, do you see a lot of emotional overlay, depression setting in, anxiety, that kind of thing?
Yes. Again, it's very patient-specific with the depression and or the anxiety. Sometimes it's just overall frustration without being able to get the words out, without being able to communicate with loved ones, but even just frustration overall with having a stroke and having this life-altering occurrence.
But you mentioned to me actually at one point that there are new techniques or adaptive mechanisms now mm-hmm. that are giving kind of hope to that situation. Mm-hmm. Tell me about those real briefly.
Now, this day and age of technology, with all of the different smartphones and tablets or iPads, there is a lot more at hand to talk about, and patients and families have access to these things more readily, whereas once upon a time it would have been something very, very expensive in order for these patients to have and to utilize, but now just something that everybody has, a smartphone and or a tablet.
And how do they use them for communication?
There's certain apps that we can that can be downloaded and or purchased. A lot of times we use a lot of the light versions or free versions to trial to determine if it's something that the patient can and will successfully use prior to purchase, because some of the adaptive or augmentative applications can be pricey. So we want to trial those before actually recommending purchasing.
But the purpose of them basically is to help augment or adapt a person who's having some communication limitations.
Yes.
And they've been successful. And that's new. That's
yes.
Really very, very new. So, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, social isolation is a big issue, especially as you noted with people with communication limitations. You've started some kind of a support group for that. Tell us about that.
Yes, we've started the Central New York Stroke Support Group. And one of the reasons we started the group is I have patients that we're seeking social supports and a group for patients as well as family members to learn and to talk and just to network within their community. And we were finding that there's very limited resources within this community for a stroke support group's family members, caregivers.
So this was an unmet need that you basically are meeting right now.
Correct.
Is the group current?
Yes.
It's going on right now?
Yes.
And how frequently do you meet, and what's the mission of your group?
We meet one time a month, and our mission is to educate both patients, families, and caregivers, but also to provide them an avenue for socialization and self-expression of their experiences, their feelings, their needs, but also, you know, again, to provide that avenue of social networking, meeting other patients and families that are like themselves.
How large a group do you have, or how large are you shooting for?
Well, that's a good question. We're still getting started, and hopefully as big as we need is, you know, bringing in from the local hospitals, not just our hospital alone, but bringing in from all community, and that's why we titled it the Central New York Stroke Support Group.
And who will facilitate it?
Currently, it's myself and another speech-language pathologist, Jenny Doherty, from St. Joe's Hospital. We are co-facilitating currently and meeting once a month.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful undertaking, something very, very needed, and it sounds like all the work you're doing here is really making a difference in a lot of people's lives. So I applaud your work. And thank you for coming in.
My
guest has been Carrie Garcia. She's a speech-language pathologist in the Physical Rehabilitation and Medicine Department at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much, Carrie. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. One of the enduring topics The Healing Muse receives concerns grief, such a profound and sometimes frightening emotion. I'd like to share work from two of our writers, one an essayist, one a poet, as each grapples with the aftermath of loss. The first comes from Central New York writer and self-described recovering academic Jill Swenson. Here is an excerpt from her essay, Crazy Chick Waiting for a Collect Call from the Sundance Kid. Grief hits me upside the head, knocks the wind right out of my sails, cuts me off at the knees, weighs on my chest heavier than a 2-ton truck, presses down on my shoulders, and racks my addled brain. Grief washes over me. Grief inflicts itself upon my soul uninvited and unwelcome, slips into my life on a stealth mission, takes me hostage, and shakes me down. It might be a verb, but grieve isn't something I do. It's something done to me. I try to manage my responses to the reality of death, but bodily reactions don't allow my mind much control over the matter. Lead feet, bowed head, shoulders to ears, hollow eyes, snot and tears. Grief grabs your appetite and spits it in your face. Death casts grief like a shadow upon those left living. It is a physical, spiritual, emotional, intellectual wallop. I stand in the shade of the tree of forgiveness and wail. Yes, Sam's death feels like a spanking for which I examine my conscience for the sin that evoked it. Grief can bring along its relatives, guilt, the what-ifs, and shame. Grief makes me feel naked. Every nerve is exposed and raw, sensitive to the touch, the shadow, the memory. I'm ashamed to be a widow. It's a status assigned, not elected, not my choice. I resist, but it is futile. Grief makes me regress, irritable and fussy like a teething baby. My patience, good manners, and small virtues got sucked out of my soul with his spirit's departure. The second reading is from Arizona poet Donna Pfluger. Her poem is entitled, How to Endure the Beast Called Grief. Be a grackle, shine with the glossy black of loss. Stare down grief with beady yellow eyes, screech and whistle. Raise hell in a parking lot, fight over scraps of memories, and win.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore how new ways to match kidney donors is saving lives, plus new strides in radiation oncology's quest to fight cancer, and one medical professional's foray into literature. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.